The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Shocks to the system. Two key cities fall in Iraq. Eric Cantor falls in Virginia, plus returned hostage Bergdahl in his own words and Hillary Clinton in hers.
Which way for the VA? As the FBI joins the hunt for wrongdoing, Massachusetts may show how to do it right.
The value of zero, part one. Futurist Jeremy Rifkin looks beyond the carbon controversy to a whole new energy system in the zero marginal cost society.
The value of zero, part two. How the Internet of Things may lead to a collaborative commons, less production, and the eclipse of capitalism.
When classical weds comedy, serious composer David Alpher also writes tunes for wife Jenny Litt's songs about Brooklyn life, lingerie, fatal fitness, and more.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of June 15th and Father's Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. I want to change so much and all the time, but then my mind just locks down, as if there was someone else in my mind shutting the door in my face. Those were expressions of alienation and perhaps mental instability in the diary of U.S. Army Surgeon Bo Bergdahl after leaving his post in Afghanistan and becoming a five-year hostage of the Afghan Taliban. Now this.
They're 100 miles from Baghdad. And what's the president doing? Taking a nap.
My team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them without sending U.S. troops to play whack-a-mole wherever there ends up being a problem.
I was in my district every week. So, there is a balance between holding a leadership position and serving constituents at home. But never was there a day did I not put the constituents of the 7th District of Virginia first, and I will continue to do so.
We came out of the White House not only dead broke, but in debt. And we struggled to piece together the resources for mortgages, for houses, for Chelsea's education. It was not easy.
All week long, the shocks kept coming. Iraq engulfed in a near civil war and pressure on President Obama to get the country to re-engage there to halt what 4,500 U.S. lives and more than $1 trillion were not able to forestall, even with subsequent additional equipment and training of flaky government forces. Also, the first ever primary defeat of a House Majority Leader, despite Eric Cantor's professed local loyalty, and with the future of immigration reform perhaps in the balance. And political veteran Hillary Clinton, presumptive heir to the Democratic presidential nomination, seemingly tone-deaf on her family's finances compared with those of most hard-pressed Americans.
It was almost enough to quiet the controversy over five-year prisoner of war, Bo Bergdahl, over why he left his post in Afghanistan, and over propriety of releasing five top Taliban from Guantanamo to finally get him back to this country last week. Almost, but not quite, in a political culture grown ever more polarized and uncompromising, according to a new Pew poll, at least where Obama and his policies are concerned. To consider all these and related issues for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by veteran TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a contributor at thedailybeast.com. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you. Hi.
Let's start with the new threat in Iraq. What do your sources say are the most likely recommendations Obama will get from his team, assuming that they and the Pentagon haven't been working on this problem, at least hypothetically, for months? And many saw it coming.
Well, the Iraqi president was in Washington several months ago and was asking for military help. But the administration does not see it as America's responsibility to go in and try to stave off a civil war. But what's happened in now explosively in the last several days is really a takeover by an extremist group, ISIS or ISIL, it's known variously. And I think it is in the U.S. core interest to help the Iraqi government repel these extremists, because if they were to set up a safe haven or even a government in Iraq, that directly threatens the U.S. So I believe the president is considering some sort of air support, possibly the use of drones. He's ruled out ground troops, but I think there is a kind of a movement really towards trying to provide some sort of military assistance.
What about Vice President Biden's much earlier plan to let Iraq be divided among the ethnic groups now fighting one another, a much looser national entity?
But Vice President Biden actually proposed that when he was still in the Senate, I believe in 2006, and he was laughed at. It looks now like it was actually rather foresighted, if that's a word, and that the Kurds and the Shiites and the Sunnis really can't get along, and the U.S. has bled alongside with the Iraqi people in that country, you know, for a decade, and hasn't been able to control that problem. And the country now does seem to be drifting towards some sort of a breakup, which is not going to be an easy solution. It carries its own pain.
Let's turn to the Cantor debacle. Despite a huge financial advantage over his little-known college professor opponent, Tea Party-oriented but not really supported by it, was the key issue Cantor's support for at least some immigration reform, his compromising on the government shutdown and other conflicts, or simply a feeling that he'd grown too remote?
Eric Cantor came to epitomize sort of the big money elites that are taking over politics. He was one of the most prolific fundraisers in Washington. And in Washington, he was seen as an obstacle to immigration reform. Yet in his district, which was actually gerrymandered to become even more conservative than it was, because he won with 79% of the vote in the primary 2 years ago, so this is quite a dramatic come down, they saw any even conversation about immigration reform as a betrayal. So, yes, I think immigration lit the fuse, but the fuse was there waiting for somebody to figure out how to take advantage of these really bigger trends that were consuming Cantor and that are really consuming the entire Republican Party.
What does Cantor's defeat and the spin on it mean for immigration reform in Congress or growing pressure on Obama to do more by executive action that he's put on hold?
Well, the president has said that he wanted to give Congress a chance to act, and the White House is still acting as though they think something could potentially happen this summer. Most analysts think that immigration reform is dead on Capitol Hill, certainly until after the November election. So that puts a lot more pressure on the president to act on his own, which in the face of all the children really coming across the border has grown into an even more volatile issue than it was.
2016 loomed large last week in all the interviews Hillary Clinton did about her new memoir. Were you surprised by her poverty defense to a question about giant speaking fees?
I actually wasn't, because if you go back and listen to Hillary Clinton over the years, she was concerned about money when they were in Arkansas. She was the breadwinner, really, in the family. She was the lawyer. She was the one who got them into the sort of the Whitewater land deal that then mushroomed into a lot of other things. And when they left the White House, when she was talking about being in debt, I think it was like $10 million in legal fees. So it's pretty daunting. But the way she expressed it, whenever you're talking about houses and you're using the multiple, most people are not going to be able to relate to that. So I think she understands that was a poor choice of words. I think she's even said that. So this is kind of a shakedown cruise for her, getting back into the thick of politics and, you know, learning what's going to ignite social media and what's safe. And she's going to look for the safe route, but I'm sure she's going to do more of this over the coming months if, in fact, she does go ahead with a presidential race.
Any surprises in the memoir?
There's a chapter on all the major countries, and in a way it reminds me of sort of term papers on these countries, and she's expecting to be graded by the voters. She doesn't give away much, but it does reflect, I think, who she is. She's dutiful. She does her homework. She is pretty good at sizing up the various players on the international scene, and so it's a book that's well worth reading, but it's quite a task. She doesn't shed any new light on Benghazi, and you know, she basically explains what went wrong, but she doesn't take any direct responsibility for it.
Veteran TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a contributor at thedailybeast.com.
Quote from the news, people are disgusted. That was Sao Paulo teacher Soraya Lunardi on the public protests and private avoidance of World Cup soccer in Brazil because of huge spending on the event instead of needed social programs and harsh police action against demonstrators. Streets were also filled with joy after Brazil beat Croatia in the opening game.
Next, the VA scandal. Is Massachusetts a model for reform? For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. We're the only developed country on earth where this happens. That was an exasperated President Obama on inadequate gun laws after a 15-year-old boy killed a fellow student, wounded a teacher, then killed himself in an Oregon high school, the 74th school shooting since the Sandy Hook massacre. Also last week, an extremist anti-government couple in Las Vegas killed two policemen, a Walmart shopper, and then themselves. Now this.
News reports suggest that the FBI is, in fact, probing the scandal at the Veterans Affairs Administration. Can you confirm those reports?
Yes, our Phoenix office is open to criminal investigation.
At a hearing of the House Judiciary Committee last week, FBI Director James Comey confirmed a criminal investigation by the Bureau into scandalous charges of neglect and cover-up at the Veterans Administration. A nationwide audit by the Department of Veterans Affairs revealed more than 57,000 veterans waiting 90 days or more for their first VA medical appointments, with even more, 64,000, requesting care but never even being added to VA waiting lists.
The FBI investigation was based in Phoenix, where the actions of VA administrators and staff spurred a nationwide survey by the VA's own inspector general that ultimately led to the resignation under fire of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki. In Phoenix, three senior VA officials also have been removed and mobile medical units deployed to speed veterans care in the area. And acting VA Secretary Sloan Gibson has vowed to spend $300 million to increase hours for VA medical staffers and contract with private clinics to see veterans unable to get care through government channels.
As the Obama administration and Congress struggle to craft more comprehensive reform of the VA, important lessons may be drawn from a state already known for health and medical pioneering: Massachusetts, home of the model for Obamacare. The state boasts three of the nation's highest-rated VA hospitals, spends more per capita on veterans than any other, and fosters extensive private efforts to collaborate on veterans care. Boston Globe Washington reporter Brian Bender has been following that story, and for your ears only, he joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
How many veterans does Massachusetts have? How much does it spend on each of them, and how does that compare with other states?
Well, Massachusetts has about 370,000 veterans, and according to statistics, spends about $173 of state money, again, as opposed to federal money, state money per veteran, and that's about double, really, the second and third highest states, which I think are Illinois and Iowa.
A significant part of the state's expenditure on vets goes to reimburse them for private health care. Talk about that and the key role played by Medicare and MassHealth, which was the model for Obamacare.
Well, I think when people look at the Massachusetts veterans situation and talk about lessons learned, I think you're right. One of the biggest lessons that they're trying to implement more nationally is to try to figure out a way that veterans can use both the VA system, which obviously is a government-run system, but also tap into the private healthcare system as part of an effort to kind of relieve the pressure on some of these VA hospitals. And Massachusetts has pretty good success in that regard, partially because of its state healthcare law, which preceded, as you said, Obamacare. So, you know, affordable healthcare is possible in the private sector in a way that hasn't been in other states. So veterans kind of supplement what they're getting at the VA through the private health care system. And I think there's some new legislation in Congress trying to give the VA more authority to reimburse veterans elsewhere for private care so that, again, you're using kind of a hybrid system and you're not completely filling up the VA.
There's also a special program with private support for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. What can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, that's another interesting phenomenon in Massachusetts. I mean, obviously the VA is dealing with a lot of recent veterans that have post-traumatic stress disorder. But in Massachusetts, again, the state Veterans Services Office has stepped in, has helped set up some community-based mental health clinics for veterans, partnered with organizations like the Boston Red Sox, Massachusetts General Hospital, so some private sector partners to also offer other services for PTSD beyond just the VA so that, again, you know, veterans have a choice, and possibly a choice that is quicker. You know, they can get a specialist quicker than they can at the VA, or it's closer to where they live than where the nearest VA mental health clinic might be.
To help vets understand their options, the state also has special coordinators in every major city and town. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's another thing that the state of Massachusetts kind of brags about. And this was something implemented by Governor Deval Patrick and his Veteran Services Secretary, Coleman Nee. And that is that basically every major town and, of course, city in the Commonwealth has a state-provided veterans outreach coordinator. So basically, their job is to kind of figure out who are the veterans and then help connect them to the various kinds of services that are available, whether it's VA, the federal system, or some of these other private and public partnerships that I've talked about. And I think that's helped kind of avoid people falling through cracks, which I think, you know, still happens in Massachusetts, of course, but not as acutely as it does elsewhere, because people out there kind of looking in those cracks.
Is there a single medical or political official in recent state history who helped focus so much public and private concern on veterans' health, or how did it happen?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people credit the Patrick administration when he came into office a number of years ago. He made veterans' issues a priority. It's interesting, too, that three members of his cabinet that have nothing to do, really, with military or veterans' issues happen to be military veterans themselves. So I think that is kind of a unique circumstance. It wasn't necessarily planned, but he's got a sort of kitchen cabinet of top advisors who know about veterans' issues, some of whom are using the VA system themselves. So I think that's also influenced how the state is approaching. And, of course, Massachusetts is smaller than some other states, like California or New York. And, of course, demographics like that always make a difference, too. If you have less, you can sort of manage things a little bit better than, say, in a place like Phoenix, where I think what they found was that, you know, you have a lot of retirees there. And even though the VA is overwhelmed by new veterans from the post-9/11 period, you know, that's really only part of this overwhelming sort of caseload. It's really the Vietnam veteran era veterans who are getting into their late 60s and in their 70s and are needing more care. So I think it's a combination of both. Massachusetts, I think, is lucky because doesn't have as many veterans as other places, but at the same time, it's, like I said, it's kind of organically grown up this hybrid system where they don't have to completely rely on the VA.
From your vantage point in Washington, do you see federal officials taking some cues from Massachusetts now?
Well, I think already they've consulted with some officials up there to find out what are some of the best practices, what are the lessons learned. You know, like Obamacare, I don't think Massachusetts' healthcare system, you know, is the perfect model for the country, but I think there are lessons there. And again, I think the biggest lesson people are looking at is the idea that you can use both the VA and the private system to help veterans. I mean, that's really what Congress is trying to do now.
Boston Globe, Washington reporter Brian Bender.
Quote from the news, "I am here to tell you and every Egyptian woman, I apologize to all of you." That was the country's new president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, to the victim of mass sexual assault by a crowd celebrating his election. In the U.S., college fraternities were increasingly the focus of campus efforts against sexual assault, often, quote, places where bad behavior gets magnified, said Senior Vice President Terry Hartle at the American Council on Education.
Next, the value of zero, a new technology economy, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. They claim to protect user privacy at the same time as they work to undermine it. That was Jeff Chester at the Center for Digital Privacy after Facebook announced it would collect even more details on its users, but now give them a chance to view and edit their profiles and opt out of specific ads directed to them. Now this.
We're just beginning to glimpse the bare outlines of a new economic system entering onto the world stage. This is the first new economic system to emerge since the advent of capitalism and its antagonist socialism in the early 19th century.
The bare outlines traced by futurist and social thinker Jeremy Rifkin at Google earlier this spring actually fill 350 pages in Rifkin's 20th and latest book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism from Palgrave Macmillan. Almost twice that number of pages if you include his new book last year, The Third Industrial Revolution.
Rifkin is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington. While scientists and politicians today debate President Obama's proposed new limits on carbon emissions from existing power plants, Rifkin looks ahead to entirely new systems of power generation and distribution, transportation, manufacturing, and work itself. It's been nearly 20 years since he was on this program, then Newsweek on Air. And for your ears only, we're pleased to have Jeremy Rifkin on the line again now. Welcome back to the program.
Nice to be with you again.
We know the Internet of Things refers to various appliances and other machines communicating with one another via the Internet. Sensors monitoring and adjusting energy use, for example, or refrigerators communicating to grocery suppliers that more milk is needed. How does that connect to a collaborative commons?
What's triggering this transformation to a new economic paradigm is something called zero marginal cost. Now, marginal costs are the cost of producing an additional unit of a good or service after your fixed costs are absorbed. So in the business community, we're always trying to reduce marginal costs. And we're looking always for new technologies that can increase productivity, reduce the marginal costs so we can put out cheaper products and services, win over consumers, and bring back some profits to the investors. And we've always believed that the best price is to sell at marginal costs. It's just that none of us ever expected in our wildest imagination, a technology revolution so extreme in its productivity that it could reduce marginal cost to near zero, making goods, services, and even energy potentially free and abundant and actually no longer subject to traditional market forces. That's what's beginning to happen.
We see the stories about large investment in giant solar arrays and wind farms to create and sell green energy. But you say the real revolution is on an individual scale, small solar cells and a new kind of internet that permits anybody to create and circulate energy like they do their own intellectual content, words, photos, videos. Talk about that technology.
It's already happening on a large scale in Europe. As you know, I advised the European Union and was privileged to develop their long-term third industrial revolution economic plan. It's moving very quickly in Germany. I've been advising the chancellor and that government since Chancellor Merkel's been in power. In Germany and in Europe, we now have millions and millions of small players, homeowners, small businesses, neighborhood associations, cooperatives, that have installed solar and wind technology on their buildings or sites. In Germany alone, a million buildings, homes, offices, and factories are now producing solar and green electricity on site. And they're sending it back to an emerging energy internet. And that energy internet operates just like the regular internet. It's becoming digitalized. So you can share that energy with each other across the entire continent from Ireland all the way to Russia. So what's interesting about this is that the fixed cost of putting solar and wind technology on your home, office, or small business, that cost is going down exponentially because it's on the same curve we saw with computer chips. You know, computers used to cost millions of dollars 40 years ago. Now you can get a smartphone in China for $25. And so the same thing's happening in solar and wind where the technology is becoming cheaper. A solar watt used to cost $60 to produce 1 watt of solar electricity in 1970. It's 66 cents a watt today and going down.
To the degree that generating power can be as easy and universal as generating blogs or posting pictures, what will that mean for the giant power companies and utilities, their profits, and their role in maintaining, expanding, and modernizing the electrical grid to handle so many small-scale power sources?
Well, important question. What's happened to the great power and transmission companies in Germany is what happened to the recording industry when Napster and the file sharing of music started to emerge, where they were wiped out in a few years. We have four big power and transmission companies in Germany, for example. Well, what's happened is in the last 5 or 6 years, millions of people have come together in cooperatives, and they have started to produce their own energy. Last Sunday, 75% of all the electricity generated in Germany last Sunday, 75% of it was renewable energy, 75%. And there was so much zero marginal cost energy that the prices turned negative that day. Now, who's producing it? Millions of small players. The big power companies are only producing less than 7% of the new green electricity. So they're basically out of the power business because they can't scale it.
Is the power actually going on the internet we know, or do we still need a modern electric grid?
Well, the energy internet is just emerging right now in Europe. The new premier, Premier Li in China, read my last book, The Third Industrial Revolution, and instructed the government of China to begin moving on this Internet of Things and concentrating really on the energy internet. I went to China to meet with government leaders, and 10 weeks after I was there, and this will be a shock to Americans, 10 weeks later, the Chinese government announced an $82 billion initial four-year commitment to lay out an energy internet, and that is to transform their entire electricity grid from an old-fashioned centralized servo-mechanical grid to a digitalized internet-type transmission grid. So in the next 4 years, that $82 billion means the whole electricity grid of China starts to transform to an energy internet, and it will allow millions of Chinese people to produce their own solar and wind green electricity in their own neighborhoods and communities at near zero marginal cost, and then share what they don't need up on an energy internet across China.
Jeremy Rifkin's 20th and latest book is The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism from Palgrave Macmillan. We'll talk more about it, do-it-yourself manufacturing, the recession of possession, and the new employment after a break.
But first, here's another quote from the news. Agents are doing everything from mixing formula to bringing in their own children's clothing. That was Gil Kirkowski, Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, after five legal groups complained that an increasing tide of unaccompanied child border crossers, 47,000 since October, were being abused and deprived of food and medical care.
Next, more of the future, according to Rifkin, for Your Ears Only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The upward trend in crashes, fatalities, and injuries involving large trucks is a cause for concern. That was a statement from the National Transportation Safety Board after charges were filed against a Walmart driver who reportedly had not slept in more than 24 hours before causing the crash that killed one person and injured half a dozen, including comic Tracy Morgan, later reported in critical but stable condition.
Now, more of our conversation with technology futurist and social thinker Jeremy Rifkin. His new book is The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism, from Palgrave Macmillan.
From the sharing of energy, your book moves on to the sharing of products, made easier by a web-connected Internet of Things. We've seen the rise of Zipcar and other services providing wheels where and when you need them, and we've heard automakers moan about the younger generation's failure to buy cars in the usual numbers. But you say the sharing has moved to toys, tools, clothing, accessories. Give us some examples.
First, 3D printing, which a lot of the young people are into, where you can get a printer now for $1,000, $1,200, and you can print out your own physical products. You don't have to get it from a centralized 20th century factory. We have hundreds of thousands of hobbyists and thousands of startup companies that are printing out 3D printed products. The software that they're using to print out the products is mostly free software, just like free software and file sharing. And the actual materials they're using to print out these three-dimensional physical products are recycled plastic from the neighborhood. You just melt it down, or recycled paper, you melt it down. Even sand is being melted down for filament. Then they're powering the 3D printed factories in Europe in some places with their own green electricity from that on site at near zero marginal cost. In a few years, and they can send what they don't need to power their factory back to the energy internet. Now, in about 4 or 5 years from now, it's already started, they can begin to use the transport internet. They're already doing with Uber, but here with manufactured products, you can send your product to market in your own electric vehicle or fuel cell vehicle, again, powered by energy at near zero marginal cost. And with GPS guidance, those vehicles will be driverless in 10 years, again, reducing the labor cost in getting your product to market. So again, you have the communication internet converging with the energy internet in a transport and logistics internet. And anyone that's used Uber knows we're already doing this with logistics, where on Uber, you can get a car within 3 minutes, that this is part of a transport logistics internet where they can inform anyone within a radius of where you want to get your car And those cars are alerted on GPS guidance, and you get a car in 3 minutes.
It permits anyone to make his car a taxi and bring it to you when and where you need it.
And it is, and it's GPS guidance in real time. They can tell you which automobiles are available to you at which times. And this is all part of the sharing economy. So what's happening is we're moving a lot of economic activity from the conventional capitalist market to this emerging collaborative commons. So we're not just sharing videos and Wikipedia knowledge and news blogs and entertainment. We're not only just sharing renewable energy now in Europe, as well as 3D printed products, we're sharing cars. Kids don't want to buy cars anymore. They want access. They don't want ownership. So we have several million young people who are using Zipcar and nonprofit services and relay rides, and they changed the auto industry, because for every car you share on the collaborative commons, 15 cars are eliminated from production. So you can imagine there's a billion vehicles in the world. Larry Burns, the former number two guy at General Motors, just did a study of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and found that the existing Internet of Things, the communication, energy, and transport Internet, just where it is now, allows us in Ann Arbor, Michigan, to have 80% fewer cars and have the same mobility and convenience we have right now. So extrapolate that to the entire world. We have a billion vehicles. We don't need 800 million of them.
With so much more automation, efficiency, home manufacturer, and sharing instead of buying, what kind of jobs will be left, and how will their pay rates compare with the new cost of living?
What we're going to see in the jobs in the next 30 years is two things. There's a short run and a long run. In the midterm, the next 30 years, there's one last surge of wage labor, mass labor. We have to build out this infrastructure. Building out the Internet of Things platform for a third industrial revolution is labor intensive. So we have to transform the entire energy resources of the world from fossil fuels and nuclear to renewables. Very labor intensive. Lots of jobs, lots of employment. We have to take the entire transmission and electricity grid of the world and transform it from servo mechanical to an internet of energy. We have to convert every building in America and around the world, existing building, to your own personal power plant, just like you have your own computer. Lots of jobs. And we have to take the entire transport and logistics grid of the world and transform it from the internal combustion engine on dumb roads to electric and fuel cell vehicles on smart roads with GPS guidance. So for 30 years, we have one last surge of labor, but here's the rub. This new system, this Internet of Things platform for a third industrial revolution, once it phases in, it's smart. It thinks. It feeds back information. It corrects its errors, and it needs a very small supervisory workforce. So what we're beginning to see is a migration of employment from the marketplace, conventional marketplace, to the civil society, the social commons, the not-for-profit sector, because that's the sector which requires humans working with humans, whether it's assisted living for the elderly, healthcare, education, culture, sports, environmental work. All of that requires hands-on. Machines can't do it. And recently, I just saw a recent study that the nonprofit sector, the civil society, is growing by 42% in revenue in the last 15 years. GDP is only growing by 16%. And employment-wise, the U.S., Canada, and U.K., already the employment in the nonprofit sector is already up to over 10% and continues to grow. So we're going to see more and more jobs moving from traditional marketplace, let the machines do it there, to more sophisticated employment where people have to use their brains and create social capital and engage in the more difficult aspects of creating a more cohesive society. So I think that's where we're headed. There's a lot of challenges. We may be derailed, but if we get to any part of this journey, become successful, it's a better world.
Jeremy Rifkin is president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington. His new book is The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism, from Palgrave Macmillan. Learn more at thethirdindustrialrevolution.com and empathiccivilization.com.
Now, this quote from the news: Billy had sorrow in her life, and every night before I go on stage, I think you are her defender. Go out there and defend her. That was Audra McDonald accepting her Tony Award as Best Actress for channeling Billie Holiday in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. Last week also saw the death at age 91 of African-American actress and activist Ruby Dee. Quote, you can only appreciate freedom, she once said, when you fight for someone else's freedom and not worry about your own.
Next, when classical weds comical. For your ears only.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. It shows what a putz you are that you go right to the weight jokes. That was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie after a quip by new Tonight Show host Jimmy Fallon. But he danced with Fallon, as had Michelle Obama, until a number titled This Bridge is Closed, at which point Christie walked off in mock disgust. Now this.
I once knew a girl who walked on a grate when a puff of hot air made her skirt elevate. Thus, exposing her thong and her thigh-high silk hosiery. Next thing she knew, for indecent exposure, she was busted by such a nice copper named Paul, who gave her a ticket to the policeman's ball.
Ralph Ranger and Leo Robin did pretty well with the 1938 tune Thanks for the Memories, but they had comic movie star Bob Hope to sell it. Thongs for the Memory, or just The Thong, has no hope, but composer David Alpher and lyricist Jenny Litt do have a lot of heart, of the Larry variety, and a lot more subjects to cover in their new CD, If Lingerie's Not to Your Liking. There's Brooklyn, Babies, Bicycling, Fatal Fitness, and A Tale of Two Apples, the title track, all in a style marrying Tin Pan Alley with Tom Lehrer or modern-day Gilbert and Sullivan.
When not working together on their marriage or their songs, Alpher is a noted classical composer and Litt a singer, vocal coach, and director. And to talk more about how they keep the music playing in their life and work, for your ears only, we're pleased to have David Alpher and Jenny Litt on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with David. What kind of music were you writing before you met Jenny at the McDowell Artist Colony?
Well, what I was writing immediately before and during was some art songs, American art songs, based on transcendental poets.
And Jenny, what artistic project brought you there?
Well, at the time, I was a full-time fiction writer. I had my MFA in fiction writing from the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I had been publishing some short stories, and I was working on a novel about a girl who runs away from home to become John Lennon's au pair, but didn't work out because he got shot the night she ran away from home. Anyway, that novel has yet to see the light of day, I fear.
But we gather you discovered a shared love of the great American songbook. Do you remember the first of the old standards that you sang together?
I think it may have been The Man I Love by George and Ira Gershwin.
What came first after that, marriage or collaboration on songs of your own?
Neither. We began to do more and more of the Great American Songbook, and we didn't start writing songs until 2004, and we got married in 2002. So I guess chronologically the marriage came first, but from 1999 to 2002, we really focused on the songs of others. The Great American Songbook, if you will.
We know with Rodgers and Hart, the music came first because Larry Hart was generally in a bar. Working with Hammerstein, the words came first. How does it work with you two?
Well, it usually works words first. And if you listen to the CD, you'll notice that there's some rather long songs, and most of the ones in which the words came first. Occasionally, we'll write a song. David will give me a tune, and I'll set lyrics to it, and those songs are generally recognizable by their brevity.
There are very few of them, but it's interesting that a couple of them date from very far back, tunes that I wrote back in the 70s that for one reason or another had no lyric that was appropriate to them, and they languished. One of them languished for 34 years, one languished for 36 years. And now there are two of the songs that we do most, and they can be heard on our CDs.
Do you try for one new song a week or a month, or is it just when inspiration strikes?
It's really when inspiration strikes and time allows. We have a kindergarten daughter, and David's away for half the week teaching and doing, you know, vocal coaching. And so we fit it in when we can.
Well, let's talk about your inspiration. Can we assume that a fetus-focused song called Hello in There was inspired by your actual daughter, now out and quite a charmer?
Yes, that was one of the tunes that David wrote back in the 70s, and it was the first one that I set the words to an already existing tune, and we just had the opening phrase, da-da-da-da, and I spent about a month trying to figure out what words match that, da-da-da-da. Finally, I was like, Hello in There, and it just flowed from there. I happened to be pregnant at the time, and I was like, bing,
When you're not singing or listening to your own songs, whose work do you most enjoy hearing for pleasure, inspiration, or outright imitation?
I tend to go back all the way to classical music because it's always been with me, and I love the structure and the discipline and the beauty of it. I drive up to Vassar every week, and I put on the Bach B minor mass, and I never get sick of it. Same with the Beethoven Seventh Symphony. They inspire me.
And Jenny, what about you?
Well, I love listening to the Great American Songbook sung by great singers like Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra. There's some contemporary songwriters in our genre who I really admire. Stephen Lutzak, who was co-writer of the Tony Award-winning Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, is one of my favorite of the contemporary songwriters. Also Goldrich and Heisler and Francesca Blumenthal, I very, very much admire.
How much live performing of your songs do you do, and where will you be doing them next in the coming weeks and months?
We are going to be doing a CD release show in Cleveland, Ohio, at Nighttown on July 13th, and we'll be doing another CD release in Kingston, New York, at the Uptown Gallery on July 26th.
Classical composer David Alpher and his comic lyricist vocalist wife Jenny Litt. Their new Two Apples CD is available at Amazon, CD Baby, iTunes, and littandalpher.com.
Here's the point of my song for devotion lifelong. You can never go wrong in a thong.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, Stitcher.com, and going back years at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hanger Studio, Play It Productions. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago.
This week, though, we go back only a month to replay our segment on A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, the new musical that swept more Tony nominations than anything else on Broadway, and last week won in four categories, from our May 4th, 2014 broadcast, hosted by Melissa Exelberth and me.
I rolled the dice with dying. It seems that all of London's shaken to the core.
One relative, one can certainly forgive.
But how can you excuse losing two?
Or three?
Or four?
Or seven? Why are all the dice dying?
I've never seen such recklessness before.
When the mourners make merry about the time and again untimely passings in a wealthy turn-of-the-last-century English family, you know there's funny business afoot, in both senses of the word. And this'll kill you, much to the surprise of many big names on stage and backstage on Broadway these days. The sly little musical from which that song came, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, written by two newcomers, last week swept up more Tony nominations than any other production this season.
It's about a young gent with major romantic challenges and only minor resources who suddenly discovers he's in line for the Dicequith family fortune behind only eight others, whose numbers then steadily diminish amid a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan-y song and dance. If it all seems faintly familiar, think of the Alec Guinness movie Kind Hearts and Coronets. And to say more about the roots of all this manic mayhem for your ears only, we're joined now by the author of the musical's book and lyrics, Robert L. Friedman. Welcome to our show.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
What were you and composer Stephen Lutzak doing before A Gentleman's Guide?
Well, Steve is considered one of the finest musical theater vocal coaches in New York. And so he's been doing that all along and writing musicals. And he also writes his own original songs, which he performs in cabarets. And he has quite a following. And I actually spent most of my career writing movies and miniseries for television, which most of which are really dramatic. So I think maybe there are some people out there who are pretty surprised that I've written such a comedy. I always kind of thought I'd be a comedy writer when I grew up, so I guess now I am.
How surprised were you when the show won more Tony nominations than any other?
Oh, my God. I mean, as they like to say in Britain, I was gobsmacked. You know, we were watching it on TV, and I just completely lost count. I mean, and then all of a sudden I heard it was 10 nominations, and it just blew my mind. I still can't believe it. It's funny, you know, I just go along doing whatever I do, and then suddenly my wife will burst out, say, 10 nominations. And, you know, we go like, it doesn't compute. Luckily, I'm just so thrilled for everybody involved in the show. Such a great group of people.
Both your musical and the Guinness movie trace to an actual 1907 novel. How did that come to be the basis for your show?
Well, you know, our first impulse was to adapt the film, and we had the rights at one time. The novel is so wonderful. It's actually called Israel Rank, The Autobiography of a Criminal. And the attitude and the style, they're all the voice of Roy Horniman, who is the novelist, who was part of Oscar Wilde's circle. And it has the same kind of wit and sense of mischief about the upper classes as you find in a lot of Oscar Wilde's work.
How long did it take to create the musical?
Would you believe 10 years? We started writing it in August of 2004. But a lot of that time was spent trying to find a producer. I mean, the upside of that is, you know, we were able to hone it and craft it and make it better than maybe it would have been if we found a producer right away. But it took 10 years.
When it came to the songs, which came first, the music like Richard Rodgers with Larry Hart or the words like Rodgers with Hammerstein?
Well, with Steve and me, I would say it's the food. We say, are you hungry? have you eaten? You know? But let's think it over that. What really comes first is the idea for the song. We think, okay, what's the dramatic situation? What's the story we want to tell? What the feeling of the music might be, and then we try to come up with a hook, a turn of phrase, or a title, and we do this all together. And then, you know, while I'm in the room, Steve might just run to the piano and come up with music for the first verse, and then we literally write the lyrics together, you know, syllable by syllable, word by word.
Did you know from the first that each of the more and less intolerable Dicequiths of both genders would be played by the same actor, and who it would be?
Well, we always knew it would be played by the same actor. I think that's why we kind of get away with all these murders, because each time he's killed, you know, he's going to come right back again. But the real find is Jefferson Mays. We have an incredible cast. And Jefferson, he's so perfect. He's so extraordinarily talented. And I often say, I think he was born to play this part of these parts, or we were born to write it for him. As I say in Yiddish, it's the shared. And that's the end of the Yiddish portion of the interview.
Do you think the Tony's attention might see your gentleman in a movie or a TV special?
Oh, my God, that'd be wonderful. Is Tim Burton listening? I don't know. That'd be great.
Do you and Ludvak have another joint project in mind, Criminal Minds the Musical?
Actually, we're working on something called Campaign of the Century, which is based on a book by Greg Mitchell. It's a true story about politics and Hollywood in the Depression. And Darko Trezniak, who's our director of Gentleman's Guide, he's going to direct it at Hartford Stage, where we tried out Gentleman's Guide, and that's going to be in the fall of 2015. So it's the same team back together, and it's also a musical comedy. It's satirical and it's heartfelt, but it just couldn't be more different from A Gentleman's Guide, and that's pretty exciting, too.
And Greg Mitchell was also a guest on this show talking about that book when I excerpted it for Newsweek many years ago. Robert Friedman wrote the book and lyrics for A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, winner of more Tony nominations than any other show on Broadway this year. Ghostlight Records recently released the Ghostlight Records recently released the original cast recording, including this.
It seems to be nothing but stubbornness. Now what's all the suffering for? To be so debased is in terrible taste. I don't understand the poor.
A Gentleman Sweeps from our May 4th, 2014 broadcast. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder won the Tony for Best Musical, and Robert Friedman took the award for Best Book of a Musical. The show's director and costume designer also won. Strangely enough, celebrated Broadway singer Audra McDonald won the Tony, her record-breaking sixth, as Best Lead Actress in a Straight Play, though it was about the last days of singer Billie Holiday and full of McDonald channeling of Holiday's vocal style.
Jessie Mueller won for her leading role in Beautiful, the Carole King musical. The awards for Best Play and Best Actor in a Play went to All the Way, about President Lyndon Johnson, and its star, Bryan Cranston. The Tony for Best Revival of a Musical went to Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and its star, Neil Patrick Harris, won for Best Leading Role in a Musical. Best Revival of a Straight Play went to Raisin in the Sun, whose original star on stage and screen, Ruby Dee, died days later at age 91. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, for Father's Day, a Brooklyn lullaby by husband and wife songwriters David Alpern and Jenny Litt.
The shopkeeper turns off his neon light. Mothers and children kiss goodnight. The subway conductor cries, "All aboard for dreams." Duty cabbie cruises by, dreaming of hot corned beef on rye. So sleep, my sweet one, rock-a-bye. An alley cat dozes on the stoop. The pigeons are safe in their pigeon coop. So sleep, my sweet one, rock-a-bye. The Italian baker kneads his dough and lights his fire so that when the night has passed, we'll have warm bread to break our fast. All of the neighbors are safe. Church bells are quiet in the Onion Dome. The freight elevator creaks up its shaft to dreamland. Under the moon's unblinking eye, all Brooklyn sings a lullaby. So sleep, my sweet one. Sleep, my sweet.